I think it's fantastic that this is coming out around the 2025 Remembrance Day, because we have 2,500 soldiers deployed overseas right now on aircrafts, on ships in Latvia, in the Middle East, in Africa, in the Caribbean, all over the place. And I don't think Canadians really realize that until it's too late, until they see something happen that's horrific, you know, on the news. And we need to remember that we still have veterans in the making today, and that in 100 years, we'll be remembering them like we remember the World War I veterans.
I spent my whole career working with veterans, and I never quit after I started. And one of the reasons for that is because how much I learned from the very beginning and continue to learn. And so it gave me so people who were through service, so these were mostly World War II veterans when I started, and actually World War I veterans. It was the way that really appreciating the importance of respect and humility. And there's a real depth that seemed to come from military service, especially for serving in conflict.
I had the pleasure of having this year's Thanksgiving dinner with one of my patients who's a 103-year-old veteran, still sharp as a tack, and still very much, you know, really reminding us about why it's important to fight for our country and to serve in different ways. And so I love the fact that I could break bread with someone who served our country. And then when they were struggling to get the services they needed, knowing that they were a veteran allowed us to move them across the country close to their family so that they could now age in the right place.
Canada's service members are individuals who have served our country with courage and commitment. Yet, as they age, many find themselves navigating a fragmented care system that doesn't fully reflect the values they upheld in uniform. In this episode of Coming of Age, we are bringing together experts from the fields of medicine and military to find out, who are Canada's veterans, and how do their care needs differ as they age? What barriers exist for accessing the right care at the right time? And what lessons can veterans care offer for broader seniors care policy? Joining us for this conversation is Major Retired Paul Hook, who brings invaluable insight and lived experience to this conversation. Paul is a fourth-generation member of Canada's Armed Forces. He has 25 years of experience in the military as a combat arms officer and is the current managing director of the Canadian Institute for Military and Veteran Health Research, which you will hear us refer to as CIMVR for short. Professor David Pedler and Dr. Samir Sinha have both contributed to a National Institute on Aging report authored by Dr. Madison Bridges, titled Addressing the Coming of Age and Its Related Complexities Among Canada's Veterans. Professor David Pedler has dedicated his career to advancing the care and well-being of Canadian Armed Forces veterans. He is a senior scientist at the University of Ottawa Institute for Mental Health Research at the Royal. He has served as the National Director of Research for Veterans Affairs Canada and the Scientific Director of the Canadian Institute for Military and Veteran Health Research. And rounding out this panel is Dr. Samir Sinha, a geriatrician and clinician scientist at Sinai Health System and the University Health Network in Toronto. Samir is the Director of Health Policy Research at Toronto Metropolitan University's National Institute on Aging. He also recently led the successful development of Canada's new National Long-Term Care Services Standard. If the goal is to restore integrity to a fragmented care system, then perhaps the key to finding a solution lies within one of the six military values. According to the Canadian Armed Forces, those who embody integrity own their mistakes, learn from them, and share their insights. They are dedicated to fairness and justice, and they don't make excuses. They make things right. Let's dive in. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to Coming of Age. It's Donna Duncan here, and I have to say, this episode is one that's really near and dear to my heart, and it is such a privilege to be able to welcome three remarkable leaders and scholars in the field of aging research, as well as veteran services in Canada. Many of our listeners know that this is something I've spoken about before, more in passing, as somebody who's had the privilege of serving on the Veterans Advisory Council for Sunnybrook Hospital and its Veterans Center, which is a national veterans center located in Toronto. Really wanting just to dig in a bit today and thinking that perhaps actually maybe we'll start with you, Dave. You were very kind enough to share some research in preparation for today's discussion. Could you just maybe give us a level set about what does the landscape look like for veterans in Canada?
So I guess it might start with how Canada defines veterans. So in this era, Canada defines veterans, anyone who completed basic training and who was honorably discharged. So that's actually a very inclusive definition of a veteran. It's similar in the UK that in other countries like the UK and Australia, definition itself is more complex. So I think that's a good start to being a veteran. But then if you go down a level, you'll find that we also have layers of legislation. So it means that veterans might experience what they have access to as veterans differently. In terms of the veterans' experience overall, we've sort of been at this since World War I. World War I set the foundation for the current sort of generation of veteran legislation. And what we found over that century is that the military service is connected to higher levels of mental and physical health challenges. But there are also era changes that have to be layered into that as well, because different eras bring different demographic groups to the table. And part of that experience is also that there are significant era changes, both in how we look at populations from a perspective of health, as well as medicine itself. So in this era, we've seen a real increase in mental health as an issue. And we're seeing the end of the World War II generation, World War II and Korean War generation. They're down to about 25,000 out of the 430,000 veterans in Canada. They used to be the primary focus of all of our business. There were over 1 million veterans in World War II. And so in this generation, we're sort of trying to find where we should go. And that's why we wrote this report together. That would be Samir's organization, the organization I'm connected to, as well as the Canadian Frailty Network, because the timing is now for us to take a look at how we're going to support the veterans who are aging in this generation. So there's similarities and differences, but I want to tell you, there's a lot of similarities in military service and its impacts over the last century since World War I.
Well, that's a great reference to the NIA report, to the National Institute on Aging. And this is where Samir, through your leadership, really building out that institute, working together with some other partners, published a report a year ago, really stepping back to look at the veterans landscape in Canada and how we're contemplating caring for veterans. I know that, I guess, about 2/3 of Canada's veterans are over the age of 55. And you know, as a geriatrician, you certainly bring that lens around. Those are different risk factors for everyone as we age. But what are some of the special considerations that I know you teased out in this report as we think about that aging demographic of the veteran community in Canada?
Yeah, thank you, Donna. So, you know, this report and this work that we did in partnership with CIMVR and the Canadian Frailty Network was really important, because when we started looking around at the issues of veterans in Canada, especially aging veterans in Canada, there weren't many, you know, pieces out there that really comprehensively characterize this population. And really what our report called for was the need for a healthy aging strategy for veterans in Canada, because as you noted right there, 2/3 of our veterans are 55 and older. 42% of our veterans today are 65 and older. And as Dave was mentioning, when we look back to, you know, our populations of veterans, I think a lot of us naturally have that image on Remembrance Day of the Cenotaph and the World War II veterans and the like, but they really represent a very small proportion of today's veterans, you know, less than 6% of the overall veterans population. The majority are people who served after 1954. And as Dave was mentioning, right, you know, that, you know, over time, the nature of service has been changing. veterans are not just going into combat situations, but even when they are, you know, the nature of combat is changing when you look at the different theaters of war and the different natures of war. But also veterans are doing a lot of other things. We'll recall, you know, Donna, I know you and I will recall quite a bit that during the pandemic, for example, we called on our military to help serve in hard hit long-term care homes across Quebec and across Ontario. When there are, you know, evacuations and natural disasters, we lean on our military more than ever now to support in those situations. And so there's a number of different things that happen. And as Dave was mentioning, when we think about our veterans as they age, for example, we have to remember that Veterans Affairs Canada has made a commitment to our veterans to make sure that we are providing them, you know, in recognition of their service, the right mix of services to what I like to say is age in the right place. So certainly those veterans who need long-term care services may be eligible for care in a long-term care home, especially the older generation of what we call war service veterans. But there's also a very novel program called the Veterans Independence Program that's really been focused on helping veterans since the early 80s to get additional supports and services beyond what our provincial and territorial governments provide so that they can age in their own homes and communities for as long as possible. So these are some of the benefits that we're providing. But we also have to recognize that not only are there services that we're providing, including services for caregivers, but we also have to note that, as Dave mentioned, that our veterans are not just aging like every other older Canadian or group in Canada. The nature of service means that veterans are more likely to be aging with more musculoskeletal issues, more mental health issues, and those sorts of things can start complicating later life needs, such as higher rates of post-traumatic stress disorder and dementia makes it harder to care for aging veterans in those circumstances. So appreciating, you know, the different nature at which veterans are aging and the different needs, I think is really important if we're going to make sure that we can be there to meet their needs, especially as our population is aging at this point.
I know that in the long-term care sector, we're spending a lot of time thinking about more specialized long-term care for people with lifespan mental illness. We're talking about more specialized, smaller homes in some cases, especially in smaller communities, more differentiated approaches and models. And I know, Samir, you're a big advocate of smaller homes, but also of more emotion-focused care models as we think about models like the greenhouse model or the butterfly model that came out of the United Kingdom. We're really trying to imagine and reimagine what aged care looks like in a very different kind of way. And our members have been having conversations, including with researchers in the space in support of veterans, in how do I identify who a veteran is? How do veterans and their family members self-identify? Are there any special considerations? We know that the census of our World War II and Korean War veterans in our specialized federally designated veteran centers is diminishing. And we're seeing more individuals from the veterans community go into sort of more traditional community long-term care when they need it. But oftentimes, I think the thing that gets neglected is what other supports do they need? Our long-term care staff are not trained for trauma-informed care. You may have other considerations around housing. You may have to think about what might be triggering. Are there other issues that and other supports that perhaps a traditional long-term care setting doesn't offer? So how do we reimagine that? But at its core really is how do we make sure that veterans are getting access to the services that they need? And if they aren't there, how do we build them? And, you know, I think that's a question. There are a lot of recommendations in your report, and I think it does speak to some of the fragmentation around access to services and how do we think about it from a more equitable lens across the country. You know, Paul, you bring a very special lens because you're a veteran. And so I'm really interested from your perspective, both wearing your professional hat, but also your veteran's hat. What are some of those considerations as we think about ensuring that the services are there? And what are some of the barriers to actually accessing the kind of services and supports across the country?
I can answer that, Don. And I appreciate you asking me to be on here, especially with Dr. David Pedler and Dr. Samir Sinha. So having seen the report that came out last year, I'm now into my third year as managing director at Simvern. So being a veteran myself, a fourth generation Canadian military member, I look at this from three different sides. So my mom is now 80. She was a nurse in the military. My dad passed away about 10 years ago. So I'm looking at my mom getting older and, you know, I need to help her navigate the system if she needs to go into long-term care. And so from a family side, we need to make sure that Veterans Affairs Canada has the information easily accessible for somebody without the experience that I have to be able to get the information needed to help that family member access the services that they're entitled to. So I look at it from that lens. I also look at it from mine, having served 25 years in the Canadian military, deployed to Afghanistan, my twin brother deployed. I have hundreds of friends that worked in the military, some who are grievously injured. I think of one friend of mine, and I bring this up as a case where if you look at, there's a study done in the States, and I looked at this, just we were talking about the survivability in war. So if you look over the 250 years of the U.S. being in war, the ratio or percentage of wounded to deaths has gone from 42% during the Revolutionary War in the 1780s down to 10% during the Iraq and Afghanistan War. So what I mean is people that are wounded in war now are going to survive and they're going to come back in their 20s and 30s, having been super fit, super motivated, had a job and everything else. And they survive a war injury that would not have been survivable even in the Vietnam era or World War II. So you've got, as Samir said, you've got complex injuries that are going to make it very difficult for people to deal with. But we also know more from a medical side. I'm not a doctor, but I mean, when we talk about traumatic brain injuries, we talk about all of the ideas and concepts that people are now able to look at. What happens inside the brain when you're doing an MRI and what happens to chronic injury and how things are related, such as dementia and aging or chronic pain and PTSD. We didn't know that 100 years ago when, as David said, much of the legislation came into place in after World War I. So I look at it from that way as well, where, you know, friends of mine who were injured 10 or 15 years ago and are now 50 years old, when they get to the place, you know, the time and place when it's long-term care time or aging in the right place in the VIP, how are they going to be able to access the services? And how are we going to make it easy enough for people to get what they're entitled to without having to jump through the layers of bureaucracy that exists? And I'm not saying that as a negative to Veterans Affairs Canada. They do fantastic work in supporting people like me every day. Every time I've had a work done, whether it's on my own file or somebody else's, the people at VAC are super caring. They're as responsive as they can be given the time and crush of applications and queries that are in. But you always try and make it easier, especially given, you know, today's instantaneous generation where we're so well informed about everything. We want access to that information immediately and anything less is unacceptable. And I'm not saying that's right. It's just a fact, life and reality today. And then thirdly, look at it from my position in a veteran support organization. So I worked with Dave until he transitioned out of the scientific director position. And we always had these discussions about his work at Sunnybrook or his work in the research director at VAC and understanding what it's like to see veterans aging. And we have people that come into the office and ask us questions. So I had an 80-year-old fighter pilot from the 70s come in literally 2 weeks ago. We're hopefully going to go for coffee soon, but he wanted to know about some research that had been done because, you know, he may potentially have cancer. And so we always have to field those questions, and we're not an organization that's the experts, but we need to be able to be compassionate, you know, not only just as a research institute that looks at the health and well-being of military members, veterans, and their families, but also as a veteran, I would love to be able to help anybody answer that question. So to try and point those individuals in the right direction to get the answers they need. And so I think it's a really complex discussion, and I'm super glad we're having it today because you get people that serve 25, 35, even 40 years in the military today. And World War I, World War II in Korea, you had people that were conscripted or that joined and volunteered in the military and were in service for a very short but very violent part of their lives, right? 6 months, maybe they landed on D-Day and were wounded and were evacuated. And that was the only battle they saw. What's the difference between that individual and somebody that served 25 years, 30 years in the military, deployed to 7 different conflicts in 8 different countries and continents and everything else? And, you know, you look at an Afghan war vet today that served between the years 2001 to 2014. Was it a war? Was it not a war? Well, Canada didn't declare war on Afghanistan at the time, but I can tell you that anybody that served in Afghanistan said they went to war. So how different are they from a Korean War veteran, from World War I and World War II veteran? So the terminology may make sense and may be a difference to politicians and to bureaucracies that need those definitions to give entitlements and to give service. But to the veterans, there's no difference. You know, when I look at a World War II vet, we can relate because I did something that was, you know, similar to what they did, and vice versa. So we have that shared understanding. And I understand that, you know, those terminologies are a complex decision-making process by the government of Canada. And, you know, it's interesting to see what's happening even now with the Gulf War veterans as they hit their 30th year, and Gulf War syndrome was just officially recognized as a coded diagnosis internationally. And that will have ripple effects in Canada as well as the UK and Australia and the US. So what does that mean for aging? What benefits will those individuals get? Will they become wartime veterans or not? It's an interesting question that will continually be asked until the last Gulf War veteran dies.
It really does speak again, what is the definition of a veteran? How do we define service? And again, there's that equity lens that really needs to be overlaid. I know even when I was much younger, worked federal government during the first Gulf War, you know, really stepping back, because at that time, Canada was a country of peacekeepers, but keeping the peace in some of those countries was harrowing for our troops. And so how do we support those who actually serve? This is a pivotal time in Canada as well, as we have a new prime minister who's talking about rebuilding our armed forces, call to arms, bring everybody, if we're going to build up our defense. And so if we really do want to attract new individuals to service, I think we need to demonstrate, and this is my view, we really do need to demonstrate that we're willing to care for those who do step up and put up their hand and really come to that call to service as well. You know, Samir, you spoke earlier, and Paul was really eloquent in talking about some of the issues around some of those risk factors for our veterans. I'm really curious from your perspective, as you think about models of care, you think about access to care. What are the risks of not accessing care? And again, some of those recommendations in the NIA report, I think are really important ones as we think about building out those services. And I know you do bring a national lens as well from your work on national standards. How do we bring this discussion out more and make it a more focused discussion at this critical time?
You know, just building on what we've been talking about, and you just mentioned how our current government has made, you know, international commitments to rebuild our military, to strengthen it as well. And that's why, you know, in our report, our very first recommendation was talking about a healthy aging strategy. And it's one that we don't think about when people retire from military service. We're even talking about one that extends to when someone enters into military service, one that starts thinking about if we reduce the risk and the rate of head injuries, for example, that could help lower the future risk of traumatic brain injuries that could lead to post-traumatic stress disorder, dementia, other factors as well. If we know that some of the greatest factors that our veterans are struggling with are musculoskeletal and mental health conditions, you know, what are we doing to destigmatize some of these aspects so that we can self-identify these issues early, so that we can actually take more precautions so that people are not discharged prematurely, which we found that people were because of these injuries, and then also not getting the supports they need as they are looking to live life, you know, in retirement from military service as a member of the workforce and other aspects. So there's the front end piece that we need to start weaving in when we think about this idea of healthy aging, because then, as you noted, when people do need service later on in life, for example, there are these, you know, three broad areas. at a real community-based level, we talked about Veterans Independence Program that really, you know, when we started thinking about services and supports beyond traditional access to medical and other services, but there's those supports that can help someone stay independent and healthy in their community. The Veterans Affairs Canada is also quite leading in terms of making sure that, you know, these services are reviewed and revised. And this is where we're saying, you know, what are the further considerations that we can have with the changing nature of service? So thinking about higher rates of mental health issues or physical, you know, disabilities, for example, how do we make sure that the Veterans Independence Program, you know, can encompass those supports better so we can better support veterans? There's also a novel caregiver recognition benefit that Veterans Affairs Canada introduced. It can provide up to $1,200 a month, you know, to support those who are providing care to a veteran. And that's the veteran themselves identifying whoever they want, you know, in their circle to say, this is my caregiver. This is a person providing me support to stay well in the community. But then, as you noted as well, that some of our veterans will eventually need to be in long-term care homes, for example. And how do we start thinking about the right models and the right supports and services that can better support our veterans there? And that's where we start thinking about, you know, as you know, Donna, that 90% of the people living in long-term care homes, you know, are living with a cognitive impairment, and two-thirds with dementia. But now when we think about a veteran who might have dementia and there's a higher risk of PTSD and that experience of trauma, how are we making sure that our staff and our homes are engaged so that when they get to know every resident, for example, they can almost anticipate that this is a veteran that I'm caring for. These might have been some of the theaters of war. They might have served in Afghanistan. They might have served in a peacekeeping mission in Kosovo, for example. Like, they may have seen things, and therefore, if we're now starting to see behavioral issues that are happening in a person with cognitive or certain actions, how do we anticipate that this may be them reliving trauma? This may be other things. And so how do we have the tools and the supports to better, you know, support these individuals as well? I think it's, you know, what we really called in our report is just being better aware. But the other aspect is, as you noted, as we're rebuilding our military now, and as we've been, you know, continuing to recruit into service, you know, we generally have seen that we have a much more diverse military in Canada. But when you look at the research around, you know, veterans, especially, and those who are serving, a lot less research specifically on the needs of some very diverse veterans, such as those who are racialized, those who are women, those who are members of the LGBTQ community, for example. And so as we know that we're going to be recruiting a much more diverse military as well, we need to make sure that we're also doing research and thinking about what are the specific needs, especially when women who served are more likely to have experienced sexual trauma during their service, for example, as well. So how are we thinking about that as well when we're thinking about the unique needs in that way? But that's kind of how we've looked at the Canadian situation. But maybe at a later point in this podcast, we can speak of some of the innovative models that have happened elsewhere in the world too, that also give us some food for thought about other unique ways in which we can better support our veterans as well.
Yeah, no, I really would love us to get there. But first, I want to ask Dave a question. And Paul, you may have some thoughts on this as well. So for our international listeners, in Canada, we have a division of powers where healthcare is a provincial jurisdiction. And it's often felt that the federal government should keep its fingers out. That being said, the federal government gives transfers to the provinces and gives money to them to support the delivery of healthcare for the population of each province and territory. The federal government has responsibility for the military, veterans, and for our First Nations. And, you know, I think some of the tensions that we're navigating now is this sense that the federal government doesn't want to move into, in many cases, the provincial domain of healthcare, but yet our veterans are federal responsibility and they served our whole country. And so, you know, I'm really curious as to how can we do better in better aligning and integrating the federal and provincial supports for our veterans. You know, I think to your point, Samir, there are some models in other jurisdictions that provide an opportunity for us, and they could be provincial, but they could also be federal, or they could be both. We oftentimes get federal subsidies in different programs. And, you know, we know the United States really does a remarkable job in supporting its veterans. It has veteran hospitals and other veteran programs funded by the federal level. I'm curious, Dave, in your research, I know you've been traveling around the world and been to various conferences. You mentioned you've just been to Australia, the Commonwealth. Sometimes there are some more interesting parallels when we're looking at the Commonwealth countries, but how do we do better in bridging that? And is this something that we should think more about, the weight of the federal role over the provincial role, or should it be a provincial role? I'm throwing that one at you.
I think the systems that are likely to do the best are a fully integrated end-to-end healthcare systems. So the U.S. Veterans Administration comes the closest to that, because if it's not an end-to-end integrated healthcare system, then there's all kinds of points where the systems don't connect, and therefore they have to be joined in other ways. An example of that could be if you wanted to monitor suicide risk, let's say in veterans, and a veteran, say in Australia or Canada, could be seeing a private provider, somebody who's at the provincial level likely, or from someone from Veterans Affairs Canada, a case manager. So there's all kinds of issues there if we wanted to try and monitor and stay more closely connected to that veteran. And also some of the newer models that are using AI and various algorithms to try and help us get smarter around how we can track populations, it requires connectivity and a patient record that's connected. So our system from the start has a lot of challenges because of the way it's designed, which means that at a practical level, there can be problems coordinating at the case level and at the services level, where provinces and the federal government might approach the same issue in different ways. So there can be, you know, coordination issues that have to be worked out. Now, I think the way Canada has tried to solve that is through case management. So there's 400 case managers who work in Veterans Affairs. So that would be one strategy, which is that you create somebody who is more responsible for, say, higher risk situations, you know, cases or individuals. And it's their responsibility to try and monitor and pull services together in a way that will work most effectively. But that requires fidelity across the capability and training of case managers and different knowledge across different jurisdictions. So, but I think, you know, effort to try and integrate care would be a key solution, which is actually something that's hard to achieve. So that might get back to eligibility as well. So one of the weaknesses in eligibility in the first case is it already sort of looks at a veteran more from the perspective of one or two health problems at the start, because the foundation of eligibility in Canada started with compensation, medicine, and service connection. So it meant that veterans who had multiple problems, which may or may not have been connected to military service, are most likely to get served along the line of, you know, one or two health conditions. So for the last 20 years, I can say Veterans Affairs has been trying to move away to that, to a more holistic perspective. But there's probably things that could be done, like, for example, saying a veteran is a veteran, that might help us move towards a more consolidated approach, both within organizations and across organizations, to try and better address this problem. And then just for one final comment, I just wanted to say that another issue here that I think Paul Hook really brings to the table is that this is a life course business. So if you look at Paul, let me guess his age is 43. But what we're actually talking about for someone like him and the 42,000 others who served in Afghanistan is that we're actually probably looking out to 2070 or 2080 right now when we're looking at Paul and thinking about his care needs across his life course. And so I think that's the way we should be thinking about it. And it's really our responsibility as Canadians to look at it that way. And that allows us to think about what Samir mentioned as well, which is how do we intervene earlier to make later life outcomes better for people like Paul? And the bar is set high. After World War I, we brought in the War Veterans Allowance. That was a big change in income programs for Canada. And it was brought in for that reason. It's because compensation medicine didn't take us far enough. Some veterans were burned out and they couldn't be pensioned for all the problems they had. And then after World War II, we brought in the Veterans Independence Program. So I think we've set the bar really high in terms of what our expectations should be for this generation. And I think healthy aging is the way that we could change Paul's future and people like Paul.
Wow. So, Paul, I hope you're not feeling objectified, but...
I'm good. So I actually like that. So Dave and I have talked about this a little bit, and research can sometimes be boring. And I say that in all seriousness because you've got great people doing research. I had no idea while I was serving in the military that there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people devoting and dedicating their lives to researching the health and well-being of military members, veterans, and their families. So what they're doing today is going to impact policies and decisions 10, 20, 30 years from now. If I look at how I transitioned out of the military, the policies that were in place just 2 years ago have been updated already by today. And that's because of the research that happened 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so Dave's quite right in that looking at the research that we need to do now and that will inform policies and guide decisions by the government of Canada out to 2080 are hugely important. The first female infantry officer, Sandra Perrin, her movie just came out, a couple of weeks ago on the red carpet? That was in the 1980s. I think she's maybe in her late 50s, maybe 60 years old. A fantastic person. So what's going to happen, you know, when that generation of women enter into the time when they need long-term care, whether it's, you know, aging in the right place. So you look at all the equipment issues that women still have in the military, the ill-fitting equipment that cause all the musculoskeletal injuries. As Samir said, a lot of the issues that come up with sexual assault in the military that have come out through numerous reports over the last decade. And so we have all of those things that are going to come to a head in the long-term care space in a little bit. And from a veteran side, you know, you asked the question, what is the ideal? And from a military side, from a veteran side, I don't think we don't want an ideal. We want the system that it is now to work seamlessly. So if I go on to veterans.gc.ca and type in long-term care, if there's some information that says about this program, it says community beds or contract beds. And then it says, quote, the assessment process and admission to long-term care facilities is managed by your provincial, regional, or local health authority. Please contact the agency responsible for long-term care in your province and territory. There's a link for 13 of those territories and provinces. So picture the veteran who has problematic anger or who has a TBI or that was blown up and is angry at the system that's been broken for them. And I'm not saying that the system is broken. I'm saying for them, it doesn't work because it's not responsive to their specific needs or it's not easy for them. Like when we're in the military, we take care of somebody from cradle to grave. When they join the military, they're shown where to go to get a haircut, to get their first uniform. Then through their whole career, we put them on courses. We send them to medical appointments. We book their medical appointments. We remind them that they have medical appointments. We put them on career courses. We book their travel. We tell them they're going here, they're going there. We give them food vouchers. We give them claims. We give them a house. We tell them they're moving from one place to another and we book their travel. We book their house. We book their moving company. We book. Then when they leave the military and they have to do all of that on their own, how is somebody that is struggling mentally or physically expected to be able to do that without getting upset, without feeling that the social contract that Canada has with its veterans was broken? And I never thought of it that way until I talked to a few people that I know that have problematic anger or PTSD, and they say they can't focus. And so if I can do something that's quite easy of linking into the VAC system for benefits, it's a great system. But for somebody that's struggling, it may be problematic. And then how do you access the resources to actually get into that system? How are you going to know what long-term care entitlements you have without clicking through 13 links on the internet because you can't speak to somebody in person? Because we only have 400. What did you say, Dave? We have 400 individuals dealing with case managers. So we have 400 case managers for 460,000 veterans. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. It is what it is. But one person to deal with 1,000 cases on it, like just think if everybody had a case manager, if everybody needed to be dealt with as a person, as an individual, as a veteran who sacrificed their life, blood, and soul for this country, how is one person responsible for 1,000 people? It's not their fault, but it definitely becomes their problem because then they have to be able to explain those entitlements, those resources. So I think that all of the work that's happening now is definitely going to be able to set Canada up for success to support the veterans as they age in the right place, whether that's in their home, in their community, in long-term care. How do caregivers and care providers support those veterans? And these are all great conversations. And it's fantastic because having these conversations means that we're going to get better and better every day.
Your comment about the social contract and, you know, Dave, I like your comment, a veteran is a veteran. Once the veterans go into the provincial pools, as they were in Ontario, and Samir knows this, in Ontario, we have a wait list of 48,000 individuals waiting for specialized long-term care. The majority of admissions now are direct from a hospital. They are not from community. Even in, or certainly seeing that increasing, including in our smaller rural and northern communities. And so accessibility is a challenge for everyone. And when we know that so many of our veterans who we may perhaps not have prepared for, so the peacekeepers, to your point, Samir, who may have been in Bosnia or may have been in the Congo and may have seen really horrific things, or those, Paul, you spoke about the Gulf War veterans, we have this cohort where we know we're not ready for the baby boomers writ large. The capacity across Canada is not there for our older generation. And now we have this subset of our aging demographic that we are especially not ready for. And our frontline staff are not ready for how we can actually support them for successful transitions. And whether that's into a community long-term care space, or as they did after World War I and World War II, where they actually built very specialized veteran centers funded by the federal government to support those who had served in the First and Second World Wars and in Korea. We kind of cut that off now. And so, you know, I think we are at such a critical point right now as we think about what is our duty and responsibility, what is that moral responsibility that we have as a society for those who did enter into this social contract with us, for the not only to protect Canadians, but to really enter into those global conflicts in support of a greater good. And that seems to get lost. And I do think that this is a critical juncture. So how do we navigate that? And what are some of those solutions, Samir, that you've alluded to, where we can find a path to support a very diverse population of Canadian veterans who have served and at a time that we know that broader demand is going to really be putting a pressure on the entire health system, not only in Ontario, but across the country?
Yeah, no, Donna, these are really good points. And certainly as a geriatrician, you know, I've always, whenever I have an older patient, one of the questions I routinely ask if I'm meeting them for the first time is, have you ever served? Because if they're a veteran, my eyes light up because all of a sudden I know that compared to a typical older person, they are likely entitled to various supports and services beyond what a typical person would be able to receive. But then it's that challenge where you find that people getting connected to the right services isn't always going as smoothly as possible. I think it's also interesting to appreciate how services have evolved over time and why we don't necessarily have these large veteran hospitals being built, for example, or specialized long-term care centers. It's, as Dave explained to me with the history of these services, you know, when you talk about your World War I, your World War II, your Korean War veterans, for example, they were all serving at a time before we had Medicare established in our country. And so that social contract, as we noted, said, we are there to meet all your care needs. And that included meeting the long-term care needs, you know, of veterans as well. And part of the reason, the impetus, as I understood, for the development of the Veterans Independence Program in the early 80s was because you had over a million World War II veterans, for example, and just the sheer need for long-term care services in a long-term care home would be incredibly costly. And so that's where this real proactive aging in the right place approach, you know, helping people age in their own homes, became a model, a very practical model to say, if we can do more to support veterans in their own homes and communities, that's going to save Veterans Affairs Canada a lot of money from having to institutionalize people, if you will. And so, you know, it's one of those wonderful opportunities where, you know, I think our broader provincial and territorial governments could also appreciate that it's often more cost effective. It's more in line with what people want to support people in their own homes, as, you know, from that perspective. And so I think that's why the VIP program, that's why I think Veterans Affairs has been quite leading in the services they have. Now, for these post-Korean War veterans, you know, they were now graduating at a time, or they were retiring at a time, where we now had Medicare. And so I appreciate that that's why Veterans Affairs Canada, you know, the contract for these veterans has changed, the social contract, where if you need, you know, services, you know, to support you in the community, we will supplement above and beyond what you are eligible for from your provincial and territorial governments. If you need additional supports and services, we will be there for you, as opposed to we are the sole provider because your governments don't provide that. So understanding how that's evolved, for example, I think, you know, it links back to what Paul was saying now, is that there is a more complex web of services that may be available, but too many people are struggling to access those services. And it might be to the fact that there's one service coordinator for 1,000 veterans. So as we're thinking about growing our military, you know, in a substantial way, I'd love to see part of these billions of dollars in investments being to make sure that, you know, if we're going to try and attract and recruit and retain a great people into service, we need to make sure that we can tell them, well, our contract to you is we're going to keep you healthy and independent, you know, as long as possible during your service. But also after that, we're there for you in the way that Paul said, that if you need help accessing services from your provincial or territorial governments, we can be there to help. We will be there to supplement appropriately so that you can age in the right place. And, you know, perhaps we are funding additional supports and services so that homes, you know, provincial and territorial homes and other settings actually have access to the education and supports that are needed. So that if a home wants to specialize in the care of older veterans, or if a home particularly now has a veteran under its care, their staff and their teams have access to those supports and services as well. But I think one of the other things that we pointed out in our report, or there were some ideas that we could maybe import from other places. And one of the really cool initiatives, and I think, Donna, you know that I've been talking about this, is just because we have 48,000 people on our wait list, you know, in Ontario for long-term care homes, is there more an intermediary model or an alternative model to having people in a home? You know, for example, in the Veterans Administration in the United States, they've actually created a real innovative model called medical foster home. And it's the idea that for veterans who may be underhoused, or the decision is either between staying in your own residence or having to move into a long-term care home, they've actually created a new intermediary model where a veteran could move in with a family. So this is what they call medical foster care for veterans. And that family is given the funding and support to provide for your basic care needs and supports. And then you get other supports, you know, such as medical and others through this community-based structure. And it's a really innovative model where, again, we try and say, is institutionalization always the right piece? Or could this be, you know, a nursing home without walls model, or a way that we can actually provide more capacity in our system when even for regular citizens, the current systems that we have just can't even meet the needs of our aging population, let alone our veterans. So this is where I think there's an opportunity for looking at innovative models, ways that we can enhance the Veterans Independence Program, maybe look at additional models like medical foster care, for example, but then also more enhanced models of long-term care, home care, that's also geared towards the needs of veterans as well. So there are so many areas in which we can better enhance, but I think that's why we'd love to see a healthy aging strategy through Veterans Affairs Canada, but also within our broad military services in general. So we can just recognize that these are things that we need to think about through, you know, no matter how old a person is, but also to make sure that we really do say, this is our social contract to you, and we'll be there, you know, right till the end.
Always love your perspective, Smear, because you're always so thoughtful. Dave, you're the historian here. First, I want to ask you, what do you see as the greatest opportunity for us in Canada as we think about veteran support? And then, Paul, I'm going to come to you because I'm really interested in your insights, including to the point that you made around families and the role of families. And I think our veterans and our military have always been actually better at supporting families than other parts of our system. We'll start with you, Dave.
I think I'll build on what Samir said. I think we should build on our strengths first, which I think that, like, the Veterans Independence Program was a gold standard program. It was very innovative when it was started in the 1980s. And I think it's still a strong program nationally today. So I think enhancing that, and I think what Samir is saying in another way, is giving even more choice across the spectrum of care so that veterans can make choices that can fit needs best. The second one Samir already mentioned as well, I think, is an area of caregiving. I think that's an area where, again, Veterans Affairs has been a leader over the last 20 years, sort of inch by inch, sort of providing more supports to caregivers. But I think this caregiver recognition benefit might actually be, you know, have actually be transformational, potentially, partly because of the amount of recognition in the sum of money, but also because the compensation is going directly to the caregiver. So that was a previous issue with the way legislation was written, was that benefits, like, say, through attendance allowance, always had to go only through the eligible veteran. And then third, I think there's still further we should go around simplifying eligibility. So believe it or not, eligibility has been simplified a lot. That might be hard for anyone here, especially Paul, to understand. But say 20 years ago, or 25 years ago, it was even much worse. But once you realize that eligibility itself is a problem for people to negotiate. Like, for example, if you open the pathways to the VIP program, is there something like 8 or 10 pathways? So I think this idea that a veteran is a veteran should be developed more. There was an attempt to do that around 2008 and 2009, and it didn't work out. There was actually a whole proposal put together by a gerontological advisory council at that time in the department that I helped run. And it just didn't make it. Part of it was cost, and a part of it perhaps was change. And then my final issue suggestion might be around mental health. And I think mental health might require more awareness and self-care than some of the other issues. So if you look at something like post-traumatic stress disorder, as a chronic illness, if that's the shape that it takes, it might have a different course than sort of what we're familiar with musculoskeletal illnesses, where someone might start to experience pain due to arthritis and really have no trouble moving forward to see their primary care doctor to move things forward. But say, I work a lot in the mental health area. So you find that something like PTSD, well, the hallmark of PTSD, or one of the hallmarks, is that people may not want to come forward, that they may actually find themselves isolated and have difficulty reaching out. So I think there's another area of self-care around awareness. And then we didn't talk about peer support, but I think this is where peer support comes in, which is for those cases or those kinds of issues where other veterans like Paul can play a role if they might be more comfortable making those connections to help people come forward. And that's often been the case with mental health. I saw it in research studies in Canada and elsewhere where people weren't surveyed until later in life and they're veterans. And then you find out that they've actually spent 50 years really suffering because they were never helped or they never came forward for help. So I think we really have to, as mental health becomes a bigger part, we have to look at that. And just to get this life course piece of this into this again, if you look at the revisions and changes to the really nicely upgraded Veteran Rehabilitation Program The rehabilitation program that started with the New Veteran Charter in 2006, but was updated in the last few years. And you look across the ages of people coming in for rehab, but you might think, well, people would mostly have rehab for, you know, 6 weeks after, you know, for maybe for 2 years after they released. But you'll find that people coming forward for the first time for rehab is happening across the life course. So the percentage of people coming, going for rehab in their 20s is approximately the same as the people over 55 coming forward for rehabilitation. So, and that's partly about people realizing that they need to come forward for goal-oriented support. So I think this whole idea around making people think from a life course perspective and to recognize that some conditions like PTSD are really going to require a different kind of awareness. And it also highlights this trauma-informed dimension of care as well, that really being aware of that can make a big difference for how well we do at delivering services and how we design them.
So you talked about families, and I would just say, I think in the 2021 survey, it was about 23% of veterans indicated that they were isolated. I think that was in the report, right, Samir? And then just a bit of higher percentage felt that they were lonely. And so if you think about somebody who's in the military and they move on average every 3 or 4 years, how do you develop a network, a family of friends throughout your life in your formative years from your, you know, when you're 18 up until you're 55? And then when you need support or care later on in your life, you haven't developed those really tight friendships because you haven't stayed in one spot. Or you were from Newfoundland, you joined the military because there were more opportunities in the rest of Canada for a job. So you spent your whole adult life away, and then you just stayed away because you were retired in a place that you put down roots. But then your family's halfway across the country. So families play an integral role with military members and veterans. You know, we used to say that the families behind those in uniform, and now it's families beside those in uniform or families with those in uniform. And we've got a great group here in Queens that created Garnered Families and the Families Matter Research Group. And there's this international consortium of researchers that look at families. And we talked to the Canadian Caregiving Center of Excellence and the work that they're doing on caregiving and care receiving and care providing, and specifically in the veteran context. So there's all of these discussions that are happening, right? And as Dave said, those that need help are going to need peers to come forward to. You know, tell them that it's okay, or provide them some resources. We've got groups like the Veteran Wellness Alliance in Ontario, the Veterans Transition Network, True Patriot Love Foundation, Wounded Warriors Canada, the Farm Project down in Nova Scotia. There's like hundreds of these grassroots organizations, and then, you know, up to national organizations that all recognize that there's a need, and not saying that they're filling the gap because VAC isn't doing their job. VAC's doing a great job. Government of Canada's doing a great job, but they recognize that there's a need because they used to be in uniform and they've seen people struggle. So as we look at what long-term care is, we know that there are people who spend every living and breathing moment of their lives in advocating for veterans and making them be better people and helping them to be better by based on the services that are available to them. So we need to make sure that families are given that type of support as well. How do they access services for themselves as well as for the veterans, right? Because you're going to get people that are burnt out caregiving for somebody in the home. How would somebody who's had to care for a veteran for 20 years as a spouse or a family member going to be a productive person in society if they're just worn down by dealing with the PTSD on a secondary basis? It's almost like secondhand smoke, right? And secondhand inhalation, you're going to be affected by that. So we need to make sure that those people are also taken care of. And how do we give them the resources that they need? And then the same thing, you talked about the caregivers in long-term care homes. There are some great researchers that are looking at military cultural competencies. There's a military veterans wellness program that was done by a police officer in Toronto. There's Lena Tamsito out of the University of Toronto and a bunch of others that are looking at cultural competency and giving the tools to medical people so that they can understand what it means. As Samir was saying, if somebody was in a position or if they were in a conflict, what, how would that present, or what's something that you can talk about or not talk about, or how would you bring up a topic in a long-term care home with somebody that's presenting with dementia, but happens to be a veteran or is also suffering from PTSD? So they're all intertwined and all, I think, understood by the broader community that we need to do more and integrate more as we talk about it and come up with better ways to help veterans as they move into the later years of their lives.
Wow. Well, well said, and a great note to end on as we think about the opportunities. And I would say that we do need to do more, to your point, Dave, using AI, ensuring there's connectivity. What other tools and resources can we use? And as Samir knows, in talking about the broader health system, it is about how do we use what we have better and smarter? How do we make sure that we are supporting those to age in place and age in their local communities, receiving the appropriate level of care and supports, whatever that may be, but also recognize that the families and the caregivers are at the heart of this as well, and that they are partners in this, and that if we're going to address these challenges and ensure that our veterans who did raise their hands in support of the greater good do get the supports and care that they need. So I want to thank all three of you for your leadership. I've learned a lot today. So again, Dave, I like your history lessons, and Samir, amplifying those, because I think we all could benefit from some history lessons. And at this critical juncture, as we've noted in Canada, we have our prime minister saying he's going to rebuild the military. I think this has been a really rich discussion around how can we do better? And clearly there's room. There's a lot of great stuff that's happening, but always better is an opportunity. So thank you.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you very much, Donna.
Thank you. What a great experience.
This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Arjo. Arjo believes that empowering movement within healthcare environments is essential to quality care. With products and solutions that are designed to promote a safe and dignified experience through patient handling, medical beds, personal hygiene, disinfection, and the prevention of pressure injuries and venous thromboembolism. Arjo is committed to driving healthier outcomes for people facing mobility challenges. Learn more about Arjo solutions at www.arjo.ca.